clearly devastated for his friend, but there was no way to do what he was asking. "I'm sorry, Dick," he said sympathetically. "I'm really sorry." When he got off the phone, he strolled over to a group of bankers that included Jamie Dimon and recounted the conversation, lamenting Lehman's fate. Dimon furrowed his brow. "I just had the most surreal conversation with a guy at Lehman," Dimon said. "He seems to be in denial." Mac just shook his head. "This is bizarre." Over at AIG, Chris Flowers, taking a break from working with Bank of America, had stationed himself at one of the secretarial desks in the hallway, waiting to meet with Willemstad. Accompanying him was Dr. Paul Achleitner of Allianz. Together, they had prepared an offer for the company. When they were invited into a conference room, they found Willemstad there with Schreiber and a group of his advisors, including Doug Bronstein from J.P. Morgan, Michael Wiseman from Sullivan and Cromwell, and several others. "We have an offer," Flowers announced, producing a one-page term sheet that he handed to Willemstad. Flowers, who hadn't yet heard about the additional $20 billion hole that J.P. Morgan's bankers had discovered, explained that he had put together a deal that valued AIG at $40 billion. The company's actual market value on Friday had been about $31 billion. Given the company's problems, he asserted, it was the best estimate he could come up with quickly. He then spelled out the rough terms. His own firm, and Allianz, would put up about $10 billion of equity, $5 billion each, and they planned to raise $20 billion from banks. They would also sell $10 billion of assets. The investment they'd be making would be directly in AIG's regulated subsidiaries, but they'd gain control of the parent company. That condition was a move to protect Flowers and Allianz. If the parent company were to falter, they'd still own the subsidiaries. Finally, Flowers said they would have to be able to convince the Federal Reserve to turn AIG into a broker-dealer, so that it had the same access to the discount window that investment banks like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley had. Before ending his presentation, Flowers added that he had one other term that hadn't been noted on the deal memo. "Bob, we would replace you as CEO." The silence that greeted the offer reflected the fact that Willemstad and his advisors thought the bid had to be a joke, not because Flowers had the audacity to tell Willemstad that he would be fired, but because the deal was also filled with potential pitfalls. Flowers was putting up scarcely any of his own money, and he hadn't lined up 80% of the funds needed to do the deal. They also thought the price ludicrously low. In their minds, the company was worth at least twice that. "That's fine," Willemstad said calmly. "We have an obligation. We'll take it to the board. But I have to tell you, you know, you've got contingencies in here that none of us can agree to," he said, referring to the need for Flowers to still receive bank financing. "Thank you," Willemstad said, and stood, trying to get them to leave as quickly as possible. As soon as Flowers departed the room, Achleitner closed the door and took his seat again. "I don't approve of what he just did," Achleitner said, almost whispering. "Well, you read the letter before you came," Willemstad said, his temper in check. No, that's not how we do business," Achleitner said apologetically. "Okay, whatever," Willemstad responded. "Thank you very much." When the entire group had finally left, Willemstad turned to Schreiber and whispered, "Don't let those guys back in the building." For a brief moment, Dick Fold allowed himself to smile. Ian Lowitt, Lehman's CFO, had just gotten word that the Federal Reserve was planning to open the discount window even wider, a move that would enable broker-dealers like Lehman to pledge even more of their assets, including some of their most toxic assets, as collateral in exchange for cash. "Okay, here we go," Fold said, believing they might be able to hang on a bit longer as they sorted out their options. "This is great, great news," Lowitt said, already tallying in his head the tens of billions of dollars of real estate assets he thought they might be able to pledge to the Fed. "We have enough collateral." Lehman's got to file immediately, Paulson, leaning back in his chair, instructed Geithner and Cox. He made it clear that he didn't want Lehman adding to the uncertainty in the marketplace by dragging the situation out any longer. Paulson had another reason for insisting that Lehman file. If the Fed was going to open its discount window even wider to the remaining broker-dealers, he didn't intend that Lehman be granted that access. Doing so would represent another opportunity for moral hazard. Cox said that he wanted to hold a press conference to announce the bankruptcy. As the sole regulator with formal authority over the firm, he felt he needed to communicate the news to the public before it crept out on its own and panic ensued. He summoned Calvin Mitchell, the head of communications for the NY Fed, and Jim Wilkinson, Paulson's chief of staff, into his temporary office and asked when a conference could be scheduled. "Well, can't you do it at the SEC office somewhere? Isn't that more appropriate?" Mitchell asked, clearly uncomfortable about arranging a media event in the middle of such chaos. "It's easier to do it here. No one is there," Cox insisted. "The journalists are here," pointing out the window at the scrum of press lined up on Liberty Street. "Okay, so we could do it on this floor," Mitchell said. "Or if we do it on the main floor, we have a podium we can bring down." Cox liked the idea of holding the press conference downstairs and added, "That's a good backdrop." As they began discussing the substance of what Cox would say at the conference about Lehman's bankruptcy, Eric Seary, the SEC's head of marketing and trading, pointed out a slight problem with the plan. "We can't announce this," Seary said. "We can't say a company has filed for bankruptcy until they decide to file, and that's a decision for Lehman's board." Just after 1 p.m., Stephen Birkenfeld of Lehman called Stephen Danhauser of Weil Gotshal, the firm's bankruptcy lawyer, frantically explaining that a group of Lehman executives, led by Bart McDade, had just been ordered to appear at the New York Fed. "You'd better get down there," he urged, and said nothing further. Seconds later, Danhauser grabbed three senior partners, Harvey Miller, Thomas Roberts, and Lori Fife, and dashed to the street to find a cab. As the four sat sweating in gridlocked traffic, Roberts took a call from a partner back at the Weil Gotshal office, who told him that Citigroup had just asked about the firm's availability to represent it as a creditor in a Lehman bankruptcy. "That doesn't make any sense," Roberts told the partner. "We're on our way to discuss a deal with Barclays." An hour after leaving the General Motors building, the cab finally approached the New York Federal Reserve building. News camera crews were still camped outside, watched over by uniformed Fed security. As the lawyers finally entered the building, they encountered Vikram Pandit of Citigroup hurrying out, looking as if he was late for another appointment. Bart McDade and other Lehman representatives had already arrived upstairs and were sitting across from several rows of government officials and lawyers. Baxter, the general counsel for the New York Fed, was clearly running the meeting, as were lawyers from Cleary Gottlieb, representing the Securities and Exchange Commission. McDade was just then telling Baxter, "You don't understand the consequences. You don't understand what is going to happen." Baxter, on noticing the arrival of the Weil Gotshal team, politely stopped the conversation to explain what was going on. "Harvey, we have had a great deal of deliberations, and we've been thinking about this a lot. And it's clear now that there isn't going to be a Barclays transaction. We've come to the conclusion that Lehman has to go into bankruptcy." Incredulous, Miller leaned forward until he was inches from Baxter. "Why? Why is bankruptcy necessary?" Miller demanded. "Can you explain? Can you please elaborate on this?" "Well, I'm not sure it's really necessary given all the circumstances," Baxter responded sheepishly. "But there's not going to be any kind of bailout, so we think it's appropriate that Lehman go into bankruptcy." Miller looked at his colleagues. "I'm sorry, Tom, but we don't understand." Alan Beller, a lawyer at Cleary Gottlieb, cut in peremptorily. "You need to do this, and it should be done before midnight tonight. We have a program to calm the markets." Miller raised his voice. "Oh, you have a program to calm the markets, do you? Could you possibly tell me what that program is?" "No, it's not necessary for your decision-making," Baxter shot back. "Tom," Miller persisted, "this makes no sense. Yesterday, no one from the Fed was talking to us about bankruptcy, and now we have to have a filing ready before midnight. And what is the magic of midnight? The only way we could ever file, and it won't be by midnight, is with a skinny Chapter 11 petition. What will that accomplish?" "Well, we have our program," Baxter repeated. Miller stood up, his 6-foot-2 frame looming over the other lawyers. "What," he slowly bellowed, is this program? Baxter just stared uneasily, offering no immediate answer. If Lehman goes into bankruptcy totally unprepared, there's going to be Armageddon, Miller warned. I've been a trustee of broker-dealers, little cases, and the effect of their bankruptcies on the market was significant. Here, you want to take one of the largest financial companies, one of the biggest issuers of commercial paper, and put it in bankruptcy in a situation where this has never happened before. What you're going to do now is take liquidity out of the market. The markets are going to collapse. Miller waved his finger and repeated, "This will be Armageddon." Baxter looked at the SEC lawyers and, considering for a moment, finally said, "Okay, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to caucus." "This is insane," Miller said to Roberts as soon as the Lehman team was alone in the conference room. "They're telling us to fucking file. The government is telling us to file." "I don't even know what to say," Roberts replied. "This has got to be illegal." About a half hour later, Baxter and the other government lawyers returned to the room, and the meeting resumed. "Well," Baxter announced, "we've considered everything you said, and it hasn't changed our position. We are convinced that Lehman has to go into bankruptcy. But what we are prepared to do is keep the Fed window open for Lehman so that the broker-dealer can continue operating the business." Baxter was making the case for compromise, that there could be a way for an orderly winding down of Lehman. The Fed would loan money to Lehman's broker-dealer unit, but not indefinitely, only as part of a bankruptcy. Sandra C. Krieger, executive vice president at the NY Fed, asked, "How much cash are you going to need us to provide you tomorrow to fund yourself on Monday night?" "It's impossible to know the answer to that," Kirk told her. "Well, that seems highly irresponsible," she replied edgily. "Really?" Kirk said, growing angry. "You want to tell me, on the $50 billion of trade selling tomorrow, how many of our counterparties are going to send us the money when we file for bankruptcy?" Seeing that the conversation was quickly devolving, Miller jumped in and asked again why this measure was necessary. "We've listened to your comments and we have concluded that our decision is correct, and we don't have to discuss this any further," Baxter said. Miller still persisted. "You are asking this company to make a very momentous decision. It is entitled to all the information it can get." "You're not going to get that information," Baxter replied. Alan Beller interrupted to say, "Look, we will have a series of releases that we are fairly confident will calm the markets tomorrow." "I'm sorry," Miller responded sardonically. "You're talking to me about press releases?" At that, the meeting was brought to a close. Greg Fleming saw Peter Kelly in the hallway at Wachtell Lipton and gave him a big bear hug. As he did, he whispered into Kelly's ear, "It's done. $29. You owe me a beer," he said with a big smile. Fleming had just gotten off the phone with Thane, who had given him the green light to go ahead with the deal at $29 a share. After an afternoon of haggling with Greg Curl, Fleming had not only persuaded him to accept the agreement, but to fund Merrill's bonus pool, up to the amount paid out in 2007. Nobody would get an employment contract, including Fleming and Thane, a point that Curl admired. To ensure that the deal would be completed, Fleming had convinced Curl to agree to a virtually airtight MAC agreement, meaning that even if Merrill's business continued to deteriorate, Bank of America couldn't later wiggle out of the transaction by claiming a material adverse change had occurred. By Curl's thinking, as he explained to Ken Lewis before agreeing to the price, "We might be able to get it for cheaper later, but if we don't do the deal today, we could lose the opportunity entirely." For Curl, a journeyman dealmaker, this was his crowning achievement. Bank of America scheduled a board call for 5 o'clock p.m., while Merrill set up a board meeting at the St. Regis Hotel at 6 o'clock p.m. to approve the deal. In a matter of hours, Merrill Lynch, with a history of nearly 100 years as one of the most storied names on Wall Street, would be sold to Bank of America for the biggest premium in the history of banking mergers. It was, as one newspaper later put it, as if Walmart were buying Tiffany's. At the NY Fed, the banks had just finished trying to unwind their Lehman positions, an effort that had not gone particularly well. The Fed had passed out a memo to the CEOs earlier in the day explaining the program, which would be an extraordinary 2-hour trading session in New York and London, during which firms that had opposing trades with Lehman tried to pair up and cut out the middleman. The process was based on the assumption that Lehman was going under. All trades conducted will be done on a contingency basis, contingent on the filing of bankruptcy of the Lehman parent, the Fed memo said. Trades will knock in if the Lehman Brothers Holding Incorporated files for bankruptcy before 9 a.m. Eastern Time on Monday. The memo was intentionally never distributed to anyone at Lehman. However neatly laid out the Fed proposal might have been, the various banks struggled to find matching trades that could remove Lehman from the picture. When frustrated traders left their desks at 4 o'clock p.m. in New York, many of them faced as much exposure to Lehman as they had on Friday afternoon. The extraordinary trading session held today to facilitate a partial unwind of these positions saw very little trading, perhaps $1 billion total, but at much wider spread levels for corporate bonds, Bill Gross, head of PIMCO, told reporters that afternoon. It appears that Lehman will file for bankruptcy, and the risk of an immediate tsunami is related to the unwind of derivative and swap-related positions worldwide in the dealer, hedge fund, and buy-side universe. Word was also starting to spread that Merrill was about to be sold to Bank of America, a rumor that Gross, one of the nation's most respected investors, said that he heavily discounted. To some extent, the rumored bid for Merrill by Bank of America lends some confidence to all markets, although I am skeptical that B of A would pay such a premium on such short notice, he said. Ruth Porat, a Morgan Stanley banker who was present at the Fed, also doubted the speculation, especially the price. She called John Prusin, Morgan Stanley's banking industry expert, to tell him the latest buzz. The rumor is $29 a share, and it's going to get announced in the morning, she told him. I can't believe it, because they didn't have time to do due diligence. It's an absurd price. Without missing a beat, Prusin replied, Then it's absolutely Ken. It's true. That's what Ken does. Are you getting all this? Gary Lynch, the chief legal officer of Morgan Stanley, was barking into the phone as Paul Colello, the chief executive of Credit Suisse's investment bank, paced nearby. With no access to a computer at the New York Fed, Lynch was in the process of dictating the text of an important press release to Jean Marie McFadden, a Morgan Stanley spokeswoman, who was typing frantically to keep up. The plan was to let the markets know that while Lehman might fail, Wall Street banks were cooperating to keep the whole financial system from imploding. The release would open, Today, a group of global commercial and investment banks initiated a series of actions to help enhance liquidity and mitigate the unprecedented volatility and other challenges affecting global equity and debt markets. It would go on to say that the world's biggest financial institutions were creating a $100 billion borrowing facility for themselves, over and above what the Federal Reserve was providing through its primary dealer credit facility. Any one bank would be able to borrow up to $35 billion from the pool. So far, 10 banks were lined up to provide $7 billion each, for a total of $70 billion. The individual banks were a who's who of the global financial system: Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, Bank of America, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, Bank of New York, UBS, Credit Suisse, Deutsche Bank, and Barclays. In normal times, many of them were the fiercest of rivals. The press release ended by stating assuredly that the industry is doing everything it can to provide additional liquidity and assurance to our capital markets and banking system. Panic was starting to build within the Lehman ranks. George H. Walker IV, head of the firm's investment management unit, sat in his office at 399 Park Avenue, scrambling to find a way to save the division. He had received bids for it on Friday from two separate private equity firms, Bain Capital and TPG, and was in the middle of trying to bring them together when he received a telephone call from Eric Felder, one of McDade's traders. Felder was talking so fast that it sounded as if he were hyperventilating. "You have to call your cousin," he insisted. "If there was ever a time to call the president, now is the time." Walker, a second cousin to President Bush, was hesitant about using his family connections. "I don't know," he said. "You've got to do it, George. Felder said to him. The whole fucking firm is going down. Someone's got to stop this. He placed the call but ended up leaving a message with the White House operators. The call would go unreturned. With bankruptcy seemingly less than hours away, a new problem suddenly confronted Steven Birkenfeld, Lehman's managing director. $18.5 million in unpaid bills from Weil Gotshal, the law firm he had hired to work on the bankruptcy filing. The debt, which was for previous legal work, was minuscule compared to the billions of dollars Lehman owed all over Wall Street. But it would prevent Weil and Harvey Miller from representing Lehman in Chapter 11. Since Weil was officially a creditor of Lehman, it would constitute a conflict of interest that a judge could use to throw Weil off the assignment. To Birkenfeld, it was critical that Weil be involved in the case. After all, its lawyers knew the firm best, and Lehman's filing was due in almost record time. For Steven Danhauser, Weil's chairman, the assignment was also of paramount importance. Judging from the size and complexity of the Lehman filing, which promised to be even bigger than Enron's, the fees were likely to be well over $100 million. Danhauser had instructed Birkenfeld to pay Weil immediately, in advance of the bankruptcy, with cash sent by wire directly into the law firm's accounts. Even this approach had risks. Being on the receiving end of such a payment could result in a law firm's being disqualified from a case. Still, with all of the pressure Lehman was under, Birkenfeld made the effort. Because it was Sunday, there was only one place that the firm had cash available to wire, J.P. Morgan, and Birkenfeld had accordingly called over and made the request. But now, Danhauser had called to say that the transfer hadn't gone through. J.P. Morgan had frozen Lehman's account, a decision that, Danhauser was told, came from the top. Birkenfeld immediately dialed J.P. Morgan's general counsel, Stephen Cutler, and furiously demanded what it meant that the decision had come from the top. "Look, I don't know what that means," Birkenfeld said, his voice rising. "I don't know if that's Jamie Dimon or someone outside the firm. But one day, we'll take your deposition and find out what happened." Cutler agreed he would try to make the payment. When Bob Diamond got back to his room at the Carlyle Hotel, tired and deflated, he had a surprise waiting for him. His wife, Jennifer, and daughter, Nellie, a sophomore at Princeton, were there. Nellie, who had been scanning the news wires on her laptop, gasped when she read that the deal her father had been trying to broker had fallen apart and headed for New York. They decided to go for dinner at the Smith and Walensky Steakhouse. Just as they were approaching the restaurant, Diamond's cell phone rang. He looked down at the caller ID and saw that it was McDade. "I can't answer it," he told his daughter, who was puzzled by his uncharacteristic timidity. "I can't do it anymore." "Dad, answer your phone," she insisted. Reluctantly, he took the call. "I've got a question," McDade said immediately when he picked up. "If we go into bankruptcy, would you consider taking the U.S. broker-dealer out of bankruptcy?" Diamond whispered to Jennifer and Nellie, "I have to take this for a second." As the women entered the restaurant, he asked, "Is that what's going to happen? Is this going to be Chapter 11? "We don't know for sure," McDade replied, "but if it goes into Chapter 11, if that's the result, would you consider taking the U.S. broker-dealer?" "Bart," Diamond told him, "that's exactly the part we want. So absolutely, we would consider it. But I have to tell you, I know nothing about bankruptcy law, and I don't know where to start. I have to talk to my board, I have to talk to John, but I'm pretty sure our answer would be yes." "Why don't we do this?" Diamond continued. "I'll get up early and get my team together, and we'll meet you at 5 a.m. But leave me an email if you haven't declared bankruptcy. You get your team, and we'll get our team." Bob Willemstad, with his advisors from J.P. Morgan, returned to the Fed on Sunday night to offer the latest update. After Paulson, Geithner, and Jester took their seats around a conference table, Willemstad told the group somberly, "We're in the same place, actually maybe a worse place than before." He explained that the hole had since grown to $60 billion and detailed what they considered to be the shenanigans of Chris Flowers' bid to everyone's amusement. Jester, taking notes, started to grill Willemstad and Doug Bronstein about the numbers. Jester didn't understand why they kept talking in ranges. He wanted to know how much money AIG needed to the last decimal point. Bronstein sighed. I can't give you an exact figure. It's difficult to get clear numbers, he said, describing the antiquated systems at AIG. It was clear to everyone in the room that AIG was now, as Willemstad expressed it, in a bind, though no one had as yet spoken of bankruptcy. Willemstad suggested again that the Federal Reserve loan AIG just enough money to avoid being downgraded by the ratings agencies. Geithner again said that that was out of the question. Given that Lehman was being left to die, Willemstad knew that Geithner's refusal was serious. Still, he persisted. I'm proposing a transaction, not a bailout, Willemstad said. If we just get the Fed's backing in exchange for collateral, I give you my word I'll sell every asset needed to pay you back. Paulson repeated with exasperation that it wasn't going to happen. Once the AIG team had left, Geithner told Paulson that they needed to start thinking about what they could do to rescue the company, perhaps via another private consortium. I don't know, Paulson said wearily. He was still preoccupied with the fates of Lehman Brothers and Merrill Lynch, and now he was supposed to find a solution for AIG? Jim Wilkinson, Paulson's chief of staff, trying to keep his boss's spirits up, marveled, "This would be extremely interesting from an analytical perspective if it wasn't happening to us." Neither Treasury nor the Federal Reserve had oversight over AIG, but if it was going to fall to someone, it would be Geithner, who seemed closest to the situation. But before Paulson washed his hands of the situation, Geithner asked him if he could borrow the services of Dan Jester, who had proved to be quite helpful over the weekend, working through many of the practical issues around Lehman and Merrill. As a former deputy CFO of Goldman, Jester understood financial services companies better than virtually all of them, Paulson said. And he was one of the few people among them who appreciated the complexities of the problem that lay ahead of them. When he was at Goldman, one of his clients back in the 1990s was none other than AIG. As the evening wore on, Jamie Dimon, now back at J.P. Morgan's headquarters, rang Doug Bronstein for an update on AIG. It's not good, Bronstein told him, referring to AIG's growing hole as a snowball. Dimon understood that AIG might have immediate problems because of a liquidity crisis, but he continued to believe that there was enormous value in its underlying business. For a moment, he started to daydream. Maybe we should be taking a look at it. There's got to be value there. Got to be. What do you mean, for us? Bronstein asked in disbelief. Yeah, Dimon replied. No, Bronstein insisted, trying to talk Dimon out of it. They don't seem to have a handle on their own numbers. I don't know, Dimon mused, still unconvinced that AIG could really be worthless. It could be a good idea. Paulson checked his watch and saw that it was past 7 o'clock p.m., which meant the Asian markets were opening, and Lehman still hadn't filed for bankruptcy. Has Cox talked to them yet? He barked at his chief of staff, Jim Wilkinson. Wilkinson said that he had been trying to get Cox to call Lehman directly, but that he had been resistant. He hasn't done shit, Wilkinson said dismissively. I went in there and repeated what you said, and it's like he's frozen, like a fucking deer in the headlights. Cox, for whom Paulson had had very little respect to begin with, was proving how over his head he really was. Paulson had assigned him the task of coordinating Lehman's filing by, well, now. This guy is useless, he said, throwing his hands in the air and heading over to Cox's temporary office himself. After barging in and slamming the door, Paulson shouted, What the hell are you doing? Why haven't you called them? Cox, who was clearly reticent about using his position in government to direct a company to file for bankruptcy, sheepishly offered that he wasn't certain if it was appropriate for him to make such a call. You guys are like the gang that can't shoot straight, Paulson bellowed. This is your fucking job. You have to make the phone call. The Lehman board had already begun its meeting when the bankruptcy lawyers from Weil Gotshal, towing wheeled suitcases stuffed with documents, finally arrived. Speaking in a subdued voice, McDade gave the directors a detailed account of what had happened at the New York Fed. He was answering their questions when Fuld's assistant came in and handed a slip of paper to her boss, who began to slump in his chair as he read it. Hold on a minute. Sorry, Bart, he blurted. Chris Cox is calling, and he wants to address us. The board members looked at one another, their surprise etched in their expressions. No one could recall a time when the chairman of the SEC had asked to address a corporate board. One director questioned whether they should even take the call, but he was overruled. What did they have to lose? The lawyers, however, cautioned that if there were any questions, only the directors themselves should speak. Fold leaned in toward the speakerphone and said in a weary voice, Chris, this is Dick Fold. We got your message, and, the board is in session here. Everyone is here, all the directors and the firm's counsel. A Lehman bankruptcy, Cox argued deliberately, stiffly, as if he were reading off a script, would help calm the market. It would be in the best interest of the nation, he said. He then introduced Tom Baxter, general counsel of the Federal Reserve of New York, who told the directors that the Fed and the SEC were in agreement that Lehman should file for bankruptcy. One of Lehman's outside directors, Thomas Cruikshank, who had led the oil services company Halliburton through the 1980s oil bust before anointing Dick Cheney his successor as CEO, was the first to speak. "Why is it so important," he asked, with a slight air of umbrage, "for Lehman to be in bankruptcy?" Cox repeated that the markets were in turmoil, and that the government had taken everything into consideration. Others followed up with variations of that same query, but Cox and Baxter stayed on message. The directors grew increasingly and visibly frustrated by the vagueness of the two men's answers. Finally, Cruikshank stated point blank, "Let me see if I understand this. Are you directing us to put Lehman into bankruptcy?" For several moments there was silence on the other end. Then Cox said, Give us a few moments, and we will get right to you. After one of the lawyers reached over the table and pushed the mute button on the speakerphone, the Lehman directors erupted with questions. "Is the SEC telling us to file? Is the Fed? What the hell is going on here?" To the best of anyone's knowledge, the government had never ordered a private firm to declare bankruptcy, essentially hanging the going-out-of-business sign on the door itself. 10 minutes later, Cox, clearing his throat, got back on the line. "The decision on whether to file for bankruptcy protection is one that the board needs to make. It is not the government's decision," Cox said in the same steady, methodical tones. "But we believe that in your earlier meetings with the Fed, it was made quite clear what the preference of the government is." John Akers, the former chief executive of IBM, interrupted, "So you're not actually directing us?" "I'm not saying anything more than what I just said," Cox replied before ending the conversation. The directors looked around at one another, dumbfounded, as Fold sat impassively, his head buried in his hands. Tom Russo, Lehman's chief legal officer, stood and outlined the board's responsibilities under securities laws. As he spoke, some directors talked quietly among themselves. "Bankruptcy seems inevitable. Do we file now? Next week?" The government, they all knew, had plenty of leverage. If they did not do what Cox wanted, who knew what the consequences could be? The Fed, which had agreed to lend money to Lehman's broker-dealer unit to allow it to fund trades, could just as easily close it and force Lehman into liquidation. There was a motion to vote on filing for bankruptcy. Henry Kaufman, an 81-year-old former Solomon Brothers economist who headed the Lehman Board's Risk Management Committee, haltingly stood up to speak. Known as Dr. Doom for his downbeat outlooks in the 1970s, Kaufman had been sharply critical of the Fed earlier in the year, accusing the central bank of providing only tepid oversight of commercial banking. Now he again took aim at the government for pushing Lehman into bankruptcy. "This is a day of disgrace. How could the government have allowed this to happen?" Kaufman thundered. "Where were the regulators?" He went on for another 5 minutes without stopping, and when he finally slumped into his seat, the other directors could only look on in sadness. As midnight approached, the resolution to file was put to a vote and passed. Some of the directors had tears in their eyes. Fold looked up and said, "Well, I guess this is goodbye." One of the bankruptcy lawyers, Lori Fife, laughed. "Oh no, you're not going any place," she said. "The board will be playing a pivotal role going forward." Miller elaborated on her point. "You're going to have to decide what to do with these assets, so it's not goodbye. We're going to be seeing each other for a while." Fold looked at the lawyers for a moment, dazed. "Oh, really?" he said softly, and then slowly walked out of the room, alone. Warren Buffett, just back in Omaha from Edmonton, had received word of Lehman's pending bankruptcy before he arrived at the Happy Hollow Country Club for a late dinner with Sergey Brin, the co-founder of Google, and his wife, Anne. "You may have saved me a lot of money," he said to the Brins with a laugh in the grand dining room. "If it wasn't for getting here on time, I might have bought something." Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who had been on the phone with Paulson, called Kevin Sheekey, his deputy mayor for government affairs, from his brownstone. "I think we have to cancel our trip to California," he told Sheekey, who was already packing his bags for the high-profile event with Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger that he had been planning for months. "The world is about to end tomorrow," Bloomberg explained, without a hint of sarcasm. "Are you sure you want to be in New York for that?" Sheekey deadpanned. Peter G. Peterson, co-founder of the private equity firm The Blackstone Group and the former CEO of Lehman in the 1970s before being ousted by Glucksmann, was watching television with his wife, Joan Ganz Cooney, when she passed him the phone. It was a New York Times reporter asking him to comment on the day's events. After pausing for a moment to take it all in, he said, "My goodness, I've been in the business 35 years, and these are the most extraordinary events I've ever seen." Christian Lawless, a senior vice president in Lehman's European mortgage operation in London, still at the office, emailed his clients Sunday night with a final sign-off. "Words cannot express the sadness in the franchise that has been destroyed over the last few weeks, but I wanted to assure you that we will reappear in one form or another, stronger than ever." At Wachtell Lipton, Ken Lewis of Bank of America had a wry smile on his face. "Wow," he exclaimed. The deal with Merrill had been concluded. Both boards had approved it, and he was waiting to share a champagne toast. But reaching the deal was not what he now found so amusing. Out of the blue, Stan O'Neill, Merrill's former CEO, had sent an email message to Herlihy that he read aloud. "I deeply regret my inability to convince the Merrill board a year ago," O'Neill wrote, referring to their secret talks last September. Then he followed up. "While I would expect the answer is no, I would offer my advice and counsel to Ken Lewis, re Merrill." That email was perhaps the only moment of levity in an atmosphere that had grown increasingly sour. Lewis had grown frustrated waiting around for the lawyers to finish with the deal documents so that he could sign them. Lewis himself hadn't gotten involved in the specific details, but the merger agreement contained a handful of side letters and separate agreements covering compensation that seemed to be taking some extra time for the lawyers to hammer out. Fleming had convinced Curl to agree to pay as much as $5.8 billion in incentive compensation, which was considered an unusual arrangement, given that that was the amount Merrill had paid out a year earlier, before the market downturn. But both Curl and Fleming felt the sum was necessary to make certain they could retain the firm's employees. It was growing late, and the Federal Reserve was still trying to get a reading of where the Bank of America-Merrill deal stood. The Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, which had been overruled by Bernanke and Geithner earlier in the week about Bank of America's capital ratios, was particularly concerned. At 9:49 p.m., Lisa A. White, assistant vice president at the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, concluded a conversation with Amy Brinkley, Bank of America's chief risk officer. White immediately sent out an email to her colleagues titled, "BAC Update." "Just got off the phone with Amy Brinkley. She says that a deal with Merrill is solidified, except for a few legal details that need to be worked out. Both boards have approved the deal, and once the legal issues are finalized, they will make an announcement." Amy indicated that BAC management feels a much higher level of comfort with Merrill than it did with Lehman, specifically with the value of the franchise and the marks on its assets. While Amy acknowledged that it may look to the outside world as if BAC is paying a bit of a premium for Merrill, BAC's estimates of Merrill's asset values indicate they are getting the firm at a 30-50% discount. Chris Flowers, the prominent private equity guru, has done extensive due diligence on Merrill over the past few months for potential equity investors, and I got the impression that BAC is at least partially relying on this work. We'll pass along more details as we get them. After Chris Flowers left AIG, heading for a walk around Trinity Church at the intersection of Broadway and Wall Street, he decided to check in with Jamie Dimon, hoping to get some insights about the status of his bid for AIG, which he had left with Willemstad in the afternoon. "What are you hearing?" Flowers asked. "Willemstad hasn't told us shit."
"You know, I think you pissed them off," Dimon told him.
"Okay, I don't know why, but I guess we did," he said, and hung up. As he walked back to 70 Pine Street, he took a moment to marvel at the huge takeover of Merrill on which he had just worked. With all the time he had been spending on AIG, it seemed almost like an afterthought. In the end, he hadn't gotten a piece of the Merrill deal, but that hardly mattered. During the weekend's insanity, his firm and Fox Pit Kelton, a boutique investment bank, had each been paid to write B of A fairness opinion. A fairness opinion is usually touted as an independent, unconflicted seal of approval for a deal, but on Wall Street, they are often seen as little more than paid rubber stamps. In this case, the situation was even more complicated, not only because Flowers himself had considered taking part in the Merrill deal, but because Flowers' firm also owned Fox Pit Kelton. For their troubles, Flowers and Fox Pit would earn a combined $20 million in fees, $15 million of which was contingent on the conclusion of the deal. Not bad for less than a week's work. Ruth Porat of Morgan Stanley had gone over to the apartment of a friend, a Lehman executive, to console her. Just as they were pouring a glass of wine to commiserate, she took a call from Dan Jester, her pal from Treasury, with whom she had just worked for over a month on Fannie and Freddie. "I need your help," he told her. "You're not going to believe this, but we think AIG may go into bankruptcy this week. I'm wondering if we can reconvene the team to focus on AIG. In this case, the assignment would be to work on behalf of the Federal Reserve. He told her that he'd like Morgan Stanley to pull a team together and be down at the Fed in the morning.
"Hold on, hold on," Porat said in disbelief. "You're calling me on a Sunday night, saying that we just spent the entire weekend on Lehman, and now we have this? How the fuck did we spend the past 48 hours on the wrong thing?"
The drive home was excruciating. Fold sat in the back seat, feeling paralyzed. Gone was the bluster, the gusto, the fight. He was still angry, but really he was just sad. For once, it was completely quiet, except for the hum of the engine and the tires rolling down the highway. He had stopped looking at his BlackBerry. By the time his Mercedes rolled into his driveway, it was 2 o'clock a.m. His wife, Kathy, was waiting up for him in bed. He slowly walked into his bedroom, still in a state of shock. He hadn't slept in days. His tie was undone and his shirt wrinkled. He sat down on the bed. "It's over," he said mournfully. "It's really over." Looking on solemnly, she said nothing as she watched his eyes well up. "The Fed turned against us." "You did everything you could," she assured him, rubbing his hand. "It's over," he repeated. "It's really over." Chapter 16. At 7:10 a.m. on Monday, September 15th, Hank Paulson was sitting at the edge of his bed in a suite at the Waldorf Astoria, the day's newspapers spread out before him. He had gotten very little sleep, worrying about how the markets would react to the previous day's news, and about whether AIG would be the next domino to fall. The headline on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, spanning all six columns and running to two lines, in double the normal point size, told the story. "Crisis on Wall Street as Lehman totters, Merrill is sold, and AIG seeks to raise cash." The Journal had gone to press before Lehman formally filed for bankruptcy protection at exactly 1:45 that morning in the Southern District of New York. Paulson was just finishing dressing when he received a call from President George W. Bush. Paulson had spoken to the president the night before, but only briefly. This would be his first opportunity to explain fully where things stood with the economy, and to strategize with him about the administration's message to the American people. His voice more hoarse than usual, Paulson began by telling Bush that Lehman's bankruptcy filing was official. "I'm sure some in Congress are going to be happy about this, but I'm not sure they should be,"
he added, acknowledging the political pressure that had been brought to bear against another bailout. Paulson said he was cautiously optimistic that investors would be able to accept the news, but warned him that there could be further pressure on the financial system. Jim Awad, managing director of Zephyr Management, was quoted in that morning's Wall Street Journal as saying, "Everybody's prepared this time. It's different from Bear Stearns. There could be a brief relief rally. You won't get a 1,000-point shock drop because we're all ready for it. But a grueling, long bear market will resume." Although the U.S. markets wouldn't open for another 3.5 hours, Paulson told Bush that the Asian and European markets were down only slightly, and while the Dow Jones futures were off, it was only by approximately 3%. Paulson then recounted the specific details of the weekend, blaming the British government for misleading them. "We were out of options," Paulson told Bush, who was sympathetic. But the president wasn't concerned about what might have been. He told Paulson that he was unhappy about the bankruptcy, but that allowing Lehman Brothers to fail would send a strong signal to the market that his administration wasn't in the business of bailing out Wall Street firms any longer. As they spoke, the first clues that the market wasn't going to take the news especially well began appearing. Alan Ruskin, a banking analyst at RBS Greenwich Capital, had sent out a note to his clients early that morning trying to divine the meaning of Lehman's bankruptcy. "At the time of writing, it seems the U.S. Treasury has decided to teach us all a lesson, that they will not backstop every deal in the wave of financial sector consolidation that is upon us," he wrote. "Their motivation is part fiscal and part moral hazard, I suspect more the latter. Presumably the most important reason to teach Wall Street this lesson is that they will change their behavior and not take the decisions that are reliant on a public bailout. For many, but not all, this is an impossible lesson to learn in the middle of the worst financial storm since the Great Depression." Paulson walked Bush through the Fed's plan to keep Lehman's broker-dealer functioning so that it could complete its trades with other banks. "We're hoping that over the next couple of days they can unwind this thing in an organized way," he said. While Paulson was clearly more disturbed than the president about Lehman's bankruptcy, he expressed his elation about Bank of America's decision to buy Merrill Lynch, a sign, he suggested, of strength in the market that might mitigate the possibility of panic. Paulson also warned him for the first time that AIG could be a problem, but assured him that Geithner and the Fed were planning to rally the troops and help raise capital for the firm later that day. "Thanks for your hard work," the president told him. "Let's hope things settle down." Doug Bronstein of J.P. Morgan was leaving his apartment on Manhattan's Upper East Side at about 7 o'clock a.m. to head down to AIG when he received a call from Jamie Dimon. "New plan," Dimon told him. "Geithner wants us to work with them to do a huge capital raise for AIG. There's going to be a meeting down at the Fed at 11 a.m. Bronstein, blocking his ear against the noise of Manhattan traffic, protested, "We can't raise this kind of money." Dimon promised that he'd have some help. "The government is inviting us and Goldman to make this happen." A look of horror came over Bronstein's face as he asked, raising his voice, "Where the hell did Goldman Sachs come from? Don't they have a conflict? I mean, look at their exposure to AIG. They're a huge counterparty." Dimon dismissed his concerns. "The U.S. government is telling us to do this," he repeated. Bronstein persisted, but "Stop it," Dimon insisted, annoyed that his top banker was challenging him. "This isn't about us versus them," he said. "We've been asked to help fix this situation." Once Bronstein got to the office, he, Dimon, and Black huddled to come up with a game plan about how to handle the Fed's unusual request. They decided to enlist the help of James B. Lee, Jr., the firm's vice chairman. Dimon hurried down the hall to give Jimmy Lee his marching orders. Lee, a classic suspender-wearing banker with a golden Rolodex, had also arrived early to help manage the aftermath of Lehman's collapse and had just gotten off the phone with one of his big clients, Rupert Murdoch. Sitting at a desk flanked by four computer screens with a giant flat-screen television tuned to CNBC's Squawk Box and his own private news ticker on the wall modeled after the zipper in Times Square, Lee spun around in his chair. "I have a job for you," Dimon barked, standing in the doorway. "I want you to go down to the Fed." "To do what?" Lee asked in disbelief. After all, he had a busy day ahead of him, and he was expecting the market to be a disaster. "I want you to run the AIG deal," Diamond told him. "Geithner called. He wants us to find a private market solution for AIG. It's a big hole. This could be the mother of all loans." If there was one banker in the city who understood the world of debt and how to raise money in a pinch, it was Jimmy Lee. He was perhaps J.P. Morgan's most senior dealmaker, a mogul unto himself, with his own banquette at the Four Seasons at lunch. His power derived, in part, from the fact that he was a virtual ATM for corporate America, writing massive checks to finance some of the biggest deals in history. Diamond told him he was hoping that Lee could structure a deal to loan AIG enough money to keep operating and sign up a dozen other big financial players to follow him. With that tall order delivered, Diamond disappeared, and Stephen Black followed him into Lee's office to give him a 5-minute briefing and a folder of AIG materials heavier than a phone book. Describing AIG as a fucking nightmare client, Black described how dire the situation was becoming. "You can carry the ball from here," Black said with a wry smile, happy to have AIG in someone else's lap. Lee was informed that he was expected at AIG for a meeting immediately, and then he had to get over to the Federal Reserve Building by 11 o'clock a.m. Lee met Bronstein and Mark Feldman in front of J.P. Morgan's headquarters on Park Avenue, where Lee's driver, Dennis Sullivan, a retired police officer who had shuttled him from his home in Darien, Connecticut to Manhattan every day for more than 20 years, was waiting with his black Range Rover. Bronstein and Lee jumped in the back so that Bronstein could continue briefing him. "Come on, we've got to get downtown," Lee instructed Sullivan. "No bullshit. We have to be down there like yesterday." John Mack looked tired as he rose to a podium and began to address his top lieutenants. It had been a long weekend, he told the managers, squeezed into Morgan Stanley's main conference room. During 2.5 days of meetings at the New York Fed, he said he had subsisted on nothing but wrap sandwiches and fruit that had been out a little too long. "I am energized, and you ought to be energized too," Mack said encouragingly. He acknowledged that the market had come under tremendous pressure after Lehman's lost weekend. United States stock index futures and bank shares in Europe were already tumbling. But the good news for them was that Morgan Stanley had survived. Mack proceeded to summarize the discussions about Lehman and Merrill that had taken place at the New York Fed over the weekend, calling Lehman's demise very unfortunate. "I mean, I wish I could come in here and say, you know, this is a great opportunity. Kick back. We're going to do great. All of the competitors have basically been eliminated." "I'm not going to say that," he allowed. "What I want to say is, kick it up, work harder. Think about what has happened this year. And what has happened is that all of a sudden, three of our competitors are no longer in business." Mack added, "I understand that all of you, and not just all of you here, but I think in the industry, are shaken. You should be shaken. But that doesn't mean that we crawl back in and we shake. We're here to do business, to serve our clients, to take market share. Just think about this. Every 1% in equity market share we gain is $1 billion in revenues. I think that once this turmoil abates, and it will settle down, the opportunities going forward are unbelievable. Now, I am a positive guy, but I am not a Pollyanna, and I believe with all my heart that this firm and our competitor, Goldman, have unique opportunities now. And I am sorry that we got to these unique opportunities the way we did. I don't want my competitors out of business. I just want to beat them." His chief financial officer, Colm Kelleher, chimed in to punctuate that point. "There is Darwinism here. Weak people are being taken out. Strong people, I believe, are going to do very, very well." Over at Lehman Brothers, the 32nd floor conference center was a beehive of activity, with hundreds of dazed people streaming in and out. Bankruptcy lawyers, restructuring experts, outside consultants, Fuld, who had been escorted upstairs by Lehman's security detail for fear that employees might actually attack him, wandered in and out of the conference rooms in shock. He had already placed a call that morning to Geithner, pleading with him to undo the bankruptcy filing, as if it had all been just a bad dream. Down on Lehman Brothers' massive trading floor, the mood was grim. The staff wasn't just devastated. They were angry, And while that anger was at first directed toward the government, it had quickly shifted to management. A wall of shame had been erected on the south side of the building, containing, among other exhibits, photos of Fold and Gregory with the caption, "Dumb and Dumber." With Lehman's holding company now officially in bankruptcy, Barclay's Bob Diamond arrived with a team to pick over the assets it wanted and leave the worst ones behind. To Diamond, it was the perfect opportunity to obtain only Lehman's choicest parts at a bargain price, and with the blessing of a judge. Barclays was mainly interested in Lehman's U.S. broker-dealer and its buildings, and this time around both the FSA and the British government had given him their support. Another plus, there was no need for a shareholder vote. Bart McDade had assembled a team to begin negotiations with Barclays. He believed there was a chance that he could save the 10,000 jobs that were likely to disappear, even if shareholders themselves had already been wiped out by the bankruptcy. Before that meeting began, however, Alex Kirk pulled McDade aside. Kirk, emotionally drained from the past week, was becoming increasingly suspicious that Barclays had dropped its bid 24 hours earlier only so that it could buy the business for even less today. He was outraged, as were many of the traders on the third floor. "Either Barclays was duped or they were part of the charade," he told McDade. "I have no interest in working for a company that's either the dupe or is part of this charade, and I have no interest in working for a highly leveraged financial institution with regulators who behave like I just saw. So I'm out on this whole thing." McDade was disappointed but sympathetic. "I get it, I understand. You do whatever you want," he told Kirk, but asked if he would stay at least through the week to help manage the trading floor as they tried to arrange a deal. Kirk reluctantly agreed. McDade then assigned Skip McGee and Mark Shafir to find a way to execute a deal with Barclays. In the cornered conference room, meanwhile, Harvey Miller was holding court with Barclays management arrayed around the table. Jay Clayton of Sullivan and Cromwell, who had previously been Lehman's lawyer with his colleague Rajan Cohen, had been hired by Barclays that morning. "I think I'm switching from shirts to skins," he said awkwardly as he sat down next to the Barclays team. Miller was trying to sort out how quickly they could sell the company, aware that in a business based on the confidence and trust of its trading partners, every second the firm remained on its own, it was losing value. Michael Klein, Barclays' advisor, announced, "We are only doing this deal if we're not bringing any liabilities with us." "What do you mean by that?" Miller asked. "Well, we're not going to buy any of these assets unless it is an absolutely clean deal," he explained. Barclays' Archie Cox jumped in and added, "And we have to close tomorrow." Miller shot a black stare at him. "Well, if that's the case, we should just discontinue this right now. Generally, a sale of even perishable assets takes 21 to 30 days. "We can't wait that long," Cox insisted. "By that time, the business will be gone." "The only thing I can think of right now is you get the court to accelerate the timelines," Miller offered. "We get an agreement in principle with the Securities Investor Protection Corporation, and it will commence a separate proceeding to coincide with this sale. But that's never been done before." "Can you do that?" Cox asked. "Until we try, we won't know," Miller replied. Timothy Geithner was sitting at his desk at the NY Fed with Jamie Dimon on the speakerphone, waiting to be conferenced in with Lloyd Blankfein, who was just returning from the firm's Monday morning internal meeting. It had been Geithner who had decided the night before, after consulting briefly with Paulson, to pair J.P. Morgan and Goldman to help AIG. By his logic, J.P. Morgan knew AIG inside out as a result of having worked for it for the past 6 months, and could get everyone up to speed quickly on the depth of its problems. Goldman, he thought, could help value the assets and syndicate the loans. "They're freaking smart," he liked to tell his staff. He knew that Goldman had advised AIG in the past, and had spent the weekend looking to buy assets themselves, so they were aware of what was going on. "Lloyd, I'm on with Jamie," Geithner said when Blankfein finally came to the phone. He explained that he was hoping to find a private market solution for AIG, and wanted Goldman to help them. "J.P. Morgan's coming down here," Geithner told him. "Can you get a team together and come over here?" "Okay," Blankfein said. "What time?" "Can you be here by 11 a.m?" "We'll be there," Blankfein replied, even though it was already past 10:15. Blankfein immediately went to work organizing a small army of the firm's top bankers: John Winks Winkelried, the co-president; David Solomon, the co-head of investment banking; Richard Friedman, who ran the principal investment area;